that everyone learned in Bible class some point along the way. We get lions and whatnot in a den, so that should be plenty exciting. Which should bother you, there's 12 chapters to Daniel, and the end of his life story is at the end of chapter 6. So what's the other half of the book about, right? So next week we get to start figuring that out. If you think it was strange so far, it gets strange in chapter 7. We get to I saw a dream one time, and it gets weird from there. Bruce is going to say a word of prayer, and then we're going to kick off and get started in Daniel 6. I've been using a commentary by a commentator named Dukewid. I don't know if that's how to say his name. I feel like if I learn how to say Bible names right, that ought to be plenty. I shouldn't have to learn commentators. So his first name's Ian. I can say that one. So Dr. Ian something or other. But he has a really good introduction to chapter 6, so I thought I would just lift the whole thing and share it with you because it's pretty interesting. But he started out by talking about the word paranoia. And he mentioned, several years back, maybe dates him a little bit, several years back there was a Mel Gibson movie called A Conspiracy Theory, and it was about a character, who had all the plan worked out, what everybody was out to get him. And he used that to define the word, paranoia, somebody who thinks they're out to get you. And he says, you might have paranoia, and you might be right. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. I mean, it could happen. And he says Christianity today sometimes suffers from paranoia, that there is so much evil in the world, sometimes we start seeing it, even if it's not there. And then sometimes we're right, and we say, see, I told you, right? Because sometimes they are out to get us. Well, he talks about the word paranoia, but then he compares it to Daniel's behavior in Daniel chapter 6, and he says this. Daniel's mindset, however, could properly be described as the reverse of paranoia. In a world in which there really were people conspiring against him and dangers on all sides, he nonetheless exhibited a peace that is truly remarkable. It is not as though he failed to understand what was happening around him. He knew that we live in an exceedingly dangerous world, a world filled with lions, not all of whom are caged in pits. Yet at the same time, Daniel also had a proper understanding of why these things are happening and, most importantly, who was in control. So I thought that was an interesting observation, that Daniel lived in a world, as we'll see in this chapter, of actual threats to his life on a regular basis, and is more calm about it than I am about the hypothetical things I worry about at night and can't go to sleep, because, you know what's going to happen, right? And he manages to live an entire life, if we can be metaphorical here, in the lion's den. I mean, he is always in harm's way, and eventually they just throw him in. But he's always in harm's way, and yet manages a peace of mind that I'm jealous of, and I suspect we all would be. Let's take a look at the first three verses of Daniel. There's enough funny words and names in this. I'll do most of the reading tonight, but it pleased Dar. Now, this is, let me just back up to last week. We ended last week talking about Darius the Mede, and you may remember I said absolutely nothing of value because I didn't know who that was, but I still don't. But the Persians have taken over. That's the important point. This is the end of the era of Babylon, and the Persians have taken over, and now we've got this fellow. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them three high officials, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps would give account, so that the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other high officials and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. A little bit of irony there that I think is funny. What had Belshazzar promised him in the last chapter? You'll be third in the kingdom. He's about to get a better promotion than that, actually, even though the person who had promised it died, just by being good at his job. He made himself valuable just by being useful and was looking for a pretty nice promotion there coming up. Age-wise, I don't know how the Bible classes do it anymore, but most of the books I remember as a kid had young boy Daniel, because you're telling this story to children and you want them to imagine themselves as Daniel, and so you have like this 18-year-old Daniel in a lion's den. Well, he was maybe 16 or 18 in chapter 1 when the Babylonians took over. But they were in charge for nearly 70 years, and now someone else is in charge, so we'll take 70 and add it to 16 or 18 or whatever. Daniel is 86, 88 years old, arguably, depending on how young you think he was and just exactly where we are in the story. I found this picture. I had to look hard to find an old Daniel in the lion's den. I kept finding, healthy young men that walked into the lion's den like they own the place, which kind of defeats the purpose of the story. But this is a very up in years, especially by ancient standards, where standard of living and extended life was not a guarantee. He's something akin to 86 years old and still wise and respected at the time this story takes place. So in six chapters, you've got to see the whole stretch of Daniel's life from teenage years to the end. As an exile, he had served Babylon. Now he serves Persia. Kind of the convenient thing for Daniel, one thing in his whole life that didn't work out very well, that did work out really well, he wasn't Babylonian. So the new guys come in, and what do? Well, they're going to throw out all the Babylonians. But we really don't know how to run the city, and we really don't know how to run the country. But we're getting rid of everybody that's Babylonian, so who's going to run the show? This guy's not Babylonian. He knows where all the bodies are buried. He knows what's going on around here. He understands things. And he has no particular loyalty to Babylon. He did a good job when he was Babylonian. He was good to the king. Now he'll be good to this king, because he doesn't belong to any of them. And so he finds himself in a uniquely useful position to the Persians, who out of all the country find three people to put in charge, and he's one of them. And out of those three, he's about to be the most important one of the three. So it's a unique position he finds himself in precisely because he was someplace he didn't belong. A local could have never had that job. Not in the way Daniel did. So it's kind of an amazing thing that Christians have. Perhaps if we have that same demeanor in our culture of knowing where we actually belong. Verses 4 and 5. Predictably, someone doesn't like it. Then the high officials and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. But they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God." So Daniel is a civil servant. But he's not made to conform to the values of that culture, even to the values of being a powerful person in a kingdom. That one hasn't changed much, okay? Being a powerful person in government has a tendency, I'm not going to say it's always the case, I like to think there are honorable statesmen out there who do their job, but it has a tendency, as we all know, to make people show favoritism, expect a bribe, expect somebody who can play ball, right? Someone who's going to get along with the system and the program. And Daniel doesn't seem to be one of those fellows. So he maintains the character that he brought with him from Judah into captivity, and now 86 years old, he is still not getting ahead because he knows all the connections and has worked all the associations, but because of his character, he's good at his job, and he's respected. So these people, because he won't play ball, he's the target of envy. Okay, he's not sharing the wealth. He's not making other people wealthy. He's not skimming off the top. He's not doing all the things that you could imagine. He doesn't spell that out here, but I think you can understand. The kind of things that you can imagine three people in charge of the kingdom are doing. And then this one, the straight shooter, is going to be put in charge. This is going to make life difficult. We really wish we would have had one of those jobs. He's not one of our people. We don't like him. And so envy raises its head, and they go and they send out the investigators to dig up dirt. October surprise, isn't that what it's called? Right? When they find the surprise and the presidential candidate and they embarrass him right before the November election and they say, aha, we had this story that we've been holding just for right now. And then the other guy says, haha, we had one on you too. And we have our investigators out trying to research and make our candidates look bad. So they turns out that's an old game too. And so they said, we're going to go find something he's done wrong. What has he done wrong? Can't find anything. Have you ever thought about running for office? Have you ever had that question? What happens if they start looking into me? Oh, never mind. I like my job, right? Because I don't know. I'd like to think I'm a pretty good fellow, but I start to wonder, what if they go looking at me? Read verse 5. We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. Could that be said about you? If we hired a team of investigators with an unlimited budget to dig up dirt on you, would they come back and report, the only thing we can find on Stephen Wetzel is he's a really good Christian? Sorry, Stephen, picked on you. I mean, that would be, what a standard to live up to. And it's not like he's a younger guy. Okay, now this is like, I'm trying not to get all political, but just for comparison's sake, it's interesting. In the last several decades, it's become very normal to appoint or nominate Supreme Court justices who are young. And that's two reasons. One, because they'll be on the Supreme Court a long time. But the other reason is they haven't done anything yet to complain about. And so they haven't had any controversial opinions. They haven't sent down any controversial orders. They haven't written any books to pull up and read in the middle of their congressional hearing. You put somebody up who's young and in the beginning of his career, this guy doesn't have any dirt on him. How long has Daniel been in office? Is he the new guy in town? 86 years. There ought to be 86 years of dirt on Daniel. And worse, he worked for the other guys. He worked for the Babylonians. Surely we can find something he was doing back then. We all know Belshazzar was a knucklehead. He was corrupt, and he worked for Belshazzar. Surely we can find nothing. Nobody can find anything except he is very faithful to his God. I'd be happy with that on my tombstone, wouldn't you? Couldn't find any dirt on Ben, but he was a really good Christian. That'd be all right. I could live with that. What a standard to live up to. And it's an impressive life. In the book of Ezekiel, just as a side note, I don't have the verse on the top of my head. Should have. Ezekiel is naming off the three most faithful people in the Hebrew Scriptures to make the point that even if their faith was here, we still wouldn't have enough faith. But he's naming off the three most faithful people in Hebrew history: Noah, Job, and his contemporary, Daniel, are the three that he names. Okay, the first two you get, their history. But to name someone that was currently alive, Daniel, and say, even his faith couldn't save us today, we're in so much trouble. Quite a testament to the kind of person Daniel was. So they conspire against him in verse 6. Then these high officials and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, O King Darius, live forever. All the high officials of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps and the counselors and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction, that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document and injunction. So I like the phrase in verse 6, the high officials and satraps came by agreement. you know, when you always want it to look spontaneous. You know, we were just all here thinking the same thing, but how does it actually happen? Well, we had 1,000 meetings beforehand so that we could walk in and act like we were all just thinking the same thing at the same time. This is a word used in Psalm chapter 2, verse 1, where it talks about the Gentiles have come together to plot against the Lord's anointed, and it's a reference they quote in the New Testament, apply it to Jesus. It's a word that means, you know, plot and scheme. This is a conspiracy. It's a legitimate conspiracy. They have planned this out, how to entrap Daniel. Good rule for life in verse 7. Never trust anybody who claims to speak for all of us. Okay? When somebody comes into the room and says, hey, we've been talking. Who's we? You know, all us. I am immediately suspicious. These people say, all of us say traps and so forth. Do they really have all of us? Well, I can tell you one they left out. And he was one of the three most important leaders in the country. I hadn't had his opinion. And if they didn't get Daniel's opinion, I wonder who else they didn't ask. I suspect they asked just enough people that they thought would say yes and be agreeable to it, just enough people that are envious of Daniel. And they go in and say, all of us say this. I'm always suspicious when somebody says, I'm speaking for everybody. Are you sure? I had one of my few interactions with municipal government back in Oklahoma City. When we lived there, we were building a house, and there was a zoning issue, and I had to go before the Board of Adjustment to show them, you know, here's why it makes sense. And, of course, it was just a slam dunk thing. There was no question they were going to agree to it, which is rare in that sort of situation. But in this case, it was. They have to tell all the neighbors, you know, this is going to be heard at a certain time so they can come complain if they want to. And sure enough, a guy showed up. One of my potential new neighbors showed up, and he didn't want a house there. And he says, I've talked to everybody. I've talked to everybody. Now, this property is next door to the Barnes Church of Christ, where I was the minister. I can tell you at least one group of people he never spoke to. And I can actually tell you four or five others. But he didn't know I was the minister at the church that was next door to the property. He just thought I was some guy moving in. And so he kept yelling. I've talked to everybody. Nobody in the neighborhood's a favor of this. And I remembered this passage, you know. I never trust people who say, I speak for everybody. That's something we say to make ourselves feel like we've really got consensus. What it usually means is, everybody who agrees with me on this. Everybody who already thought the way I thought still thinks that way. And that's a dangerous thing to trust. Beware of that. The law itself, what are they asking for? Nobody can petition to any god or man for 30 days except to you, O king. I don't think they were saying we're going to stop praying to the gods. I think they were saying we will only pray to the gods through you. No one's going to pray to Marduk. We will pray to Marduk in the name of Darius the Mede. That no one but the king had access to the gods. And certainly no other man did. So you don't go to your priest and have him pray to the gods. You pray in the name of the king. And I think that's what it means. I'm not for sure. It just seems like a strange rule to me to say to a people that are deeply in love with their own national god that it was a good idea to stop praying to him. But it makes a lot of sense in the ancient culture to say that the king spoke for the god. And the king alone spoke for the god. And no one but our king speaks for the gods. So stop talking your foreign nonsense religion. Only our king tells us who the gods are. And we don't pray to the gods except by him. In essence, putting himself precisely in the place that Jesus would claim for us. To be the one person by whom we could speak to God. Interesting comparison when you think of it that way. That could be it. As I say on the screen, it's more political than national than religious. It's not that they really care what gods you're praying to, as long as you're praying in the name of Darius the Mede. As long as you know the gods favor this kingdom and this throne and this person in power, I don't really care who you pray to after that. This is the way Rome operated. Rome didn't care who you worshipped as long as you worshipped Caesar first, and then in the name of Caesar you could offer to anybody you wanted. By the graciousness afforded us by Caesar, we now offer to Zeus. They were fine with that, as long as Caesar comes first. And I think this was kind of an early version of that. Nobody but in the name of the king. We petition through the king. That's kind of what I think. I wouldn't be dogmatic about it. But if that's the case, it sounds a lot like Nebuchadnezzar's statue, right? We're going to lift up this statue. Was Nebuchadnezzar saying he was the only gods, and the gods they worshiped beforehand and the gods they worshiped afterward weren't gods? He didn't care if you worship the gods, as long as you worship the statue first. Worship him first, and in the graciousness given to us by Nebuchadnezzar, we can now worship the gods. And so I think there's probably that connection to what's going on. Verse 10 is my favorite verse in Daniel. You ready? I like all the verses in Daniel, but 10's my favorite. I may not get past verse 10. I may just stay here the rest of the week. Okay. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. Okay. So a law is signed which cannot be changed. That's what we're told in verse 8. Daniel, in essence, says, I already have a practice, and it can't be changed either. I pray 3 times a day, and that was a rule for me long before your rule ever came into existence. It came first. That was a law that cannot be changed. Yes, Daniel, but there's a law. It doesn't make any difference. We don't even have a contemplation here. Don't you want to be a fly in the wall and listen as Daniel struggles with it and tries to figure out, what am I going to do? The way it's presented, that never even happens. Well, I always pray 3 times a day. What are you going to do now, Daniel? I'm going to pray 3 times a day. Well, you're going to pray in your closet, right? No, I'm praying in that window right there, because that's where I pray. And pause and think about that. There is no biblical command forcing Daniel to pray like this. You can read the whole Old Testament. There is no commandment that says you must pray 3 times a day. There is no commandment that says you must pray in your window facing Jerusalem. And if it did, there's no commandment that said you have to open the window so anybody could see you. It doesn't exist. So why doesn't Daniel say, okay, I'll pray somewhere else and it won't bother you? Or I'll pray 1 time a day, really quiet. There was nothing forcing him to do it. Is he naive? Does he just not know? Have they tricked him? That's important. The way it reads, it says, and when he knew it had been signed. So this isn't a trap where they passed a law and then said, gotcha. Fully aware it was illegal on pain of death, and fully aware there was nothing in the law of Moses that made him do it, he went and did it anyway. And the text gives you one reason why, because he always had. I'm a praying man. I pray 3 times a day, and that's my window. And that's the only explanation the text gives you. A commentator I mentioned earlier has this line that I thought was extra good. When prayer becomes fashionable, praying in secret may be a good thing. But when prayer is prescribed, to pray in private becomes an act of cowardice. Which is interesting. Compare this to the Sermon on the Mount. What was their problem? Was their problem they'd been told not to pray? No, they were out praying on street corners for attention. Prayer had become the thing you do to gain attention for yourself. So Jesus says, maybe you need to find a closet where your Father in secret will reward you in secret, openly. Openly, sorry. Father in secret who sees in secret will reward you openly. At a time when prayer is fashionable, maybe it's time to find a closet. But when they outlaw it, that's the time to do it in your windows. This is an act of courage, and it would be an act of cowardice not to do it. I heard a story from... name escapes me. How's that? A preacher I know. Not a preacher story in the sense that it's fictional. He is telling me his story that happened to him. He had been asked to preach at kind of one of these, or not preach, sorry. He'd asked, been asked to say a prayer at one of these kind of convocation things where, you know, there's lots of religious groups present and so forth. And he said, yeah, sure, I'd be glad to do it. Always happy to say a prayer. And then he was given the instructions. And he was told, here are some things you can't say. And one of them was, you can't pray in Jesus' name. Because we have a substantial group of both Jewish folk and Muslim folk and other folks who don't obviously pray in Jesus' name. So just say your prayer and just don't end in Jesus' name. And he was telling the story and explaining to me, he says, you know, I don't actually believe that the phrase in Jesus' name is a magic set of words that you have to end a prayer with. It's good to end a prayer with it, but I don't think God stops listening if you leave it off. But he said, after they told me I couldn't, I had to. He said, there was no choice at that point. It would be an act of cowardice not to invoke the name of Jesus, where before it might have been a matter of how do you read that passage. Now I have to do it. And he did it and got in trouble. But I think that's a good illustration of where a matter of conscience and interpretation suddenly becomes a matter of principle when somebody says, don't say your Lord's name here. Christians say, actually, that's the name I have to say. Now that you mention it, I have to say it. Yeah.
Do you think it might have been a lot of examples, too? Because Daniel was the highest ranking exile, and there were a lot of others still there. And I'm sure they watched him pretty close, because, you know, he went through all these things.
Yeah. That's a really good point. I mean, who else is watching that window? Has he become the banner carrier? Yeah, of all the Hebrews in exile, and even those who couldn't see the window, you know, knew that that's our guy up there. Three times a day, you can go by and see. That's our man. He's up there, but he prays. He's with us. And if he doesn't, what does that do for all these exiles who had looked up to this man in his story? Well, like Ezekiel said, he's the most faithful of us all. So again, I just think it's important to notice, I'm not often in favor of picking a fight, but when you do it like Daniel. There's no obligation for him to do this. He could say to himself, I'm not breaking the law of Moses if I pray one time a day instead of three, or if I do it in my closet. He's doing it because faith and courage demanded it. And he doesn't make a big fuss about it. He doesn't go into the throne room and say, well, I'll show you. He just goes to his window and does it and let the chips fall where they may. I love this verse. Yeah. He definitely, it's an interesting approach he takes. It's very calm and sedate, and yet wildly courageous. Yeah, I mean, he could, couldn't he? Wouldn't he be in his right? I mean, would anybody gripe about Daniel if he went to the king and said, well, that's not right. Esther does. Book of Esther, Esther goes in and says, this is wrong, you're killing Jewish people, stop it, and risk her life to do it. But Daniel takes a different approach. Daniel says, I'm just going to do what I do. And well, fair enough. I mean, it's definitely about Daniel. There's no question about that. But the law would have applied to anybody. It doesn't say, and Daniel will not pray, because the king is completely unaware, as we'll find out in the next couple of verses, that this was a plot to get Daniel. He just thought it was a good idea. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. James? I don't know. And that's... I'm going to come back to that. I want to talk about that, because that's interesting to me. They're very insistent the law can't be changed. I have questions about that. But it seems like Daniel was conceding that point. Daniel doesn't go in and say, oh, but you could. He says, okay, that's your law, and this is mine. And I think that's admirable. Yeah, I want to come back to that. Randy raises a point I want to talk about, as he often does. I'll blame him for it later. My clicker started doing something weird. What's it doing? Quit it. There we go. It started the clock, like I would pay attention to that if there was a clock on there. What does Daniel pray for in that verse 10, by the way? He doesn't give you the, he doesn't spell out the prayer, but what does it say about his prayer? You guys have supplications? Okay. Gave thanks is the ESV reading. It's not a word that sounds like, Lord, I'm in trouble. If there's a death threat hanging over you, do you get up into your window and say, God, I am so thankful for all that you've put in my life? But it's that's the intended word there. It's something along the lines of, it could be translated as thanksgiving, or it could even, supplication kind of has the sense of prayers on behalf of other people, but it's not something, it's not a petition like, Lord, please come save me. It's something more along the lines of, I'm so grateful for what God's done. Continue to watch out for our people. This is interesting. We get a couple of his prayers in Daniel chapter 9, when we finally get there. It's a prayer from Daniel. And in his prayer, he never once asked God to do anything for him. In Daniel 9, for 10 verses, from 3 to 13, he says, we are here because we sinned. Which is also interesting. We'll talk about it when we get there. Did Daniel do any sins to get them into Babylonian captivity? He was 18. What did he do? Which God did he worship to get them caught into Babylon? He just said, no, this is our fault. He takes blame with all of his people. He stands with them and says, we all are part of this. Knowingly or unknowingly, we were all part of this, and we are to blame, and we didn't listen to you, and that's why we're here. And then he says, please save your people, show them mercy for your own glory's sake, and restore the temple back in the homeland. He prays actually with words from Solomon. I don't know if he's intentionally quoting Solomon or not, but in 1 Kings chapter 8, when Solomon dedicates the temple that he was praying towards, Solomon said, when your people go into captivity, may they be able to pray to you and you show them mercy. And he quotes that line almost verbatim and says, now that we're here, will you show us mercy for your name's sake? And so all of his prayers are selfless. The only thing he prays for himself is to confess fault that probably wasn't his by any, you know, good defense attorney could get him off. I mean, he didn't do it. He was 18. But he says, I'll take the blame. We were all in on this. Please save your people. And as we'll get to the end of this story, I can't prove to you that Daniel ever went home. I mean, he never received even the benefits he was praying for other people. Just an entirely selfless person. I think even in this passage, you're seeing some of that. Okay, so how about those Medes and Persians? Let me read 11 through 16. Then these men came by agreement, same word, plot. And they found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. There's the word petition. And then they came near and said before the king concerning the injunction, O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition to any god or man within 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing stands fast according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Then they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed, but makes his petitions three times a day. Again, it's interesting. They call it a petition. When it's referring to Daniel, it refers to it as a supplication or thanksgiving. But they say, well, he's talking to his God over there. Who knows what he's asking for? Then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. And he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, now, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians, at no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed. Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you. So the conspirators, first, they checked to make sure the trap is set. You did sign that law, didn't you? You agree that you signed that law? Oh, yes, I signed that law. And then they say, well, busted. We caught Daniel in the act three times a day. So I'm not sure about this law of Medes and Persians. In this chapter, he's going to act like he can revoke it. Before the 30 days are up, he issues an order that says the God of Daniel's the true God. And in the book of Esther, when Haman has convinced a Persian to sign a law with his signet ring to kill the Jews. Esther convinces him it's a bad idea, and he kills Haman instead and revokes it. He doesn't? I was reading it today. So we're going to say it's technicality he got around it? He gave them arms? Okay. You see, I've got lawyers in the bunch that are saying, well, technically he kept it. He just gave them swords so that they could defend themselves. Okay. I'll let you have that one. Okay. I'm still suspicious. I don't doubt that it's it. Lenora is right, whatever the case may be. My point is, how serious is this law that can ever be broken if you can get around it by, well, I can't take back the law to kill you, but here are the swords. You know, that. And then in this case, again, the very next day, he says, well, I threw you in the lion's den, so technically I did that, but now I'm going to let you worship anybody you want and proclaim your God is the true and living God. So I wonder if it has a lot to do with saving face, that if the king establishes a law and then takes it back the next day, it shows his weakness as much as anything. And they are playing up to that. So he stays up all night trying to find a way around it, and then the next day just reverses it anyway. So that part of it is strange to me, and in the Esther story too. Lenora's going to be here bright and early tomorrow. I'm not going to show up, but she's going to show me what's in Esther. Yeah. Huh? That does help your case, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I think he's right to revoke it in the next day. I'm just curious how he gets around it. Well, that was my thought. He's king and he can do what he wants, unless there's a law that says he can't. That's supposed to be the point of the story, is that he can. Larry, do you know Persian and Median law by chance? Oh, okay. Yeah.
What is this? You do this and you do that. But I have trouble with these guys. I mean, how dumb are they? Here's a king that was so impressed with Daniel, this man, that he was going to put him over everybody else. And when he found out what they had done, you think they would?
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to win any favor by helping the king kill his own favorite, that's for sure. But it almost worked. I mean, had it not been for God, it would have worked. So I'll give him that many points, then I'll take him back, because, I mean, what happens the next day when the king says, you're the guy that cost me Daniel? This was all your fault. I do wonder what their long-term plan was. This also reminds me of Pilate. I heard a sermon one time trying to make a legal case in defense of Pilate, saying, you know, he's a Roman governor, he has to do these things, and he had to do what he did. If Pilate wants to let Jesus go, he just lets him go. And yeah, there would have been a price to pay, but ultimately, if he can release Barabbas, he can release Jesus. Ultimately, it's about saving face. He's going to look bad in front of these Jewish people. He's going to look bad in front of his superiors. And so he doesn't do it. Darius instead. Esther notwithstanding. See, I'm going to spend all week in Esther now. Thanks, Lenora. Darius offers kind of a half-hearted prayer, but no action. I hope your God saves you. Am I going to do anything about it? No. Right? But I hope your God saves you. I'll check in the morning. Maybe I'm more critical of him than I need to be, but I think it's fishy. 17 through 23. And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. And the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. Then at break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? But Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him, and also before you, O king, I have done no harm. Then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. Darius spent a sleepless night in his palace, powerless in his own kingdom to do anything. He thought. Daniel spends a much more comfortable night in a den of lions, powerless but in no need of power, because God took care of him. Duguid has a funny line here. It's not even remotely accurate, but I thought it was funny, so I thought I'd read it to you. We may almost imagine the prophet leaning back on a warm, furry lion, conversing for hours with the angel about heavenly things until he was so rudely interrupted by Darius's question. His fearsome lodging turned out to be a den of angels rather than a den of lions. Yeah, it's, again, I don't know that he was petting the lions, but it's a good line. I think it's good, right? But this idea that he ended up more comfortable in the den of lions than the king that night because of who they trusted in. The king was trusting in his system of doing things, and it had failed him. He had been caught in his own trap, as it were. And Daniel trusted in God, and when everything else fled him, he still trusted in God. And then he went to the lion's den and trusted in God, and he woke up that morning and trusted in God. So that's the reason we tell the story of the kids. 24 through 27, I'm going to run out of time if I don't hurry. And the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. Were the lions just particularly not hungry that night before? Was that the problem? No, there was no problems with the lions. They worked just fine. The other fellows don't even hit the ground. But it was about the strength of God. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, "Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions." So, interesting side note before I run completely out of time. Daniel's name, the word Daniel in Hebrew means "my God is the judge." And that night is precisely what had happened. The king wasn't the judge of this matter. The Persian law wasn't the judge of this matter. Their system of justice wasn't the judge. Ultimately, God decided who lived and who died, and he sorted this matter out. And he pronounced Daniel innocent, which was Daniel's claim. You remember when they call him in the morning, he says what? "I have done you no hurt. I said I was innocent yesterday. I'm going to say I'm innocent today, and that's why I'm alive, because my God favors the innocent." Before we're completely done, I did want to comment on verse 28 and then open for questions for anybody but Lenora and anything about Esther. But no, I read part of it today. I probably skipped the important part. That's what happens when you're in a hurry. I'm going to call you next time. Verse 28, "So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian." Daniel was prepared for the lion's den because he had lived his whole life in a lion's den. He had been in danger every moment of his life. And so at 86, what's he worried about? It reminds me a lot of the story of the Christian martyr of the first century, Polycarp, who was about 86. I'm forgetting exactly how old, but he was in his 80s when they burned him at the stake. And they took him into an arena, and the Roman governor begs him, "Just say, Caesar is Lord, and that'll be enough, and we can let you go." And he says something to the effect of, 86 years have I served him, and he's never done me any wrong. Why would I betray him now?" And they set him on fire. If you've lived a life, this goes back to our series on dying. If you've lived a life of faithfulness, you have prepared yourself, if it be in a lion's den or on the pit of fire or whatever else you find yourself in, or to a terrible disease. A life of faithfulness prepares you so that when that moment comes, what do you do next? Well, I go to my window and pray, because that's what I do. And you don't need instructions, and you don't need a battle of conscience, because you've made that decision 1,000 times before. And so, of course, you know what to do next. Daniel, the exile, with no power, saw the rise and fall of empires. How many people got to see Babylon come and Babylon go? Persia come. He outlived the empire that destroyed his homeland. That must have been an interesting sensation, right, to see that happen. "The people who destroyed me met their end." Daniel saw the promise of God fulfilled. 2 Chronicles 36, 22-23 calls Cyrus by name and said that's what was going to happen. And Daniel waited him out, and he got there. As far as we know, Daniel himself never returned home. He lived his entire life as an exile. In the first year of the reign of Cyrus, they do go home. At this moment in the story, there are people rounding up the wagons and going back to Jerusalem. Too far as we know, Daniel doesn't go. There's no indication of that. He continues his service. His place, he had made a life for himself here, serving God in this way. But he had made it possible for those people to go there and someday serve God in a rebuilt temple. All right, thanks.